news room keeps getting emptier every day, and you need resilience and a tough spirit, but everything is standing against you.
It's getting harder for me to see you like this.
There's so much despair and despondency, and it strikes terror in the heart.
The Prime Minister said leaders at the top.
I don't know what to do anymore.
That's Ravish Kumar talking to his wife in the car. Ravish, if you can talk about your decision to resign. I mean, every night, what was it, at 9 o'clock, millions of people around India tuned in to hear what you had to say. Also, your reporting on the streets as you brought the voices out of people. Talk about that decision you came to and what Modi had to do with it, the prime minister.
It was very tough to reach a decision like this. Because I've been born and brought up professionally on that floor itself. When Gautam Adani took over NDTV, it was very clear to me that the journalism of NDTV is over now. And that decision was proved after that when Hindenburg report came out. And still, NDTV went out to make 9 documentaries praising the achievement of Narendra Modi's governments during 9 years. I knew that. You cannot see Gautam Adani as an independent businessman. Yes, he may be, but he is seen in the public that he is an extension opposition's blame, alleged that this man is a part of Prime Minister's politics. So, yes, he said that there will be a difference between editorial and management, but now we can see that. Where this program channel is going on. And before Adani, ministers and spokesperson from the Bharatiya Janata Party started boycotting us. They did not appear in my show and my other colleague's show. Now one minister go on record and is reported by News Laundry, if I am correctly rephrasing it. She says that she is a prominent minister. She's saying that I have not spoken to you for long. Now, I believe there is a regime change. That's where she is making it officially that we were boycotting you. Now we are not boycotting because there is a regime change. Or what is this regime change? Pranay Roy is gone and Adani is in. So it was very clear to me, though it was very hard, and it was very heartbreaking decision for me to leave NDTV. But I had to take this decision. I could not work under that man.
You explain, first of all, what happened to Pranoy Roy and Radhika Roy, who are the founders of NDTV. You show a little bit of that in the film. And then explain why the press in India is referred derisively to as Godi media. Explain what that means.
Yes, I'm not very privy to all kind of informations and stories which Pranoy and Radhika gone through. I believe they should tell their own story. But yes, they fought a lot of cases, and even this man you showed, he covered live and spoke many bad things about him when his house was being raided. It was covered by it. Yes, they faced a lot, and I can sense that they have a house in front, just besides NDTV office. They must be feeling sad when they come out of their house. But they have to tell their story. But Indian media, we have to be very careful. We cannot be casual about this. This media has become very dangerous. Right now, this is shielding our government, our prime ministers every day. They are not giving space to opposition. This media has become so anti-opposition, so anti-minorities, anti-Muslims. You cannot imagine the scale I am talking about. I can give n number of examples to elaborate my point. But I still think that Indian media is gone. We have many things in India. We still have many robust system, which makes us hopeful that ultimately democracy will survive. But we do not have media in a true or partial journalistic sense.
Vinay, can you explain, given the fact, the description both in the film as well as what you both have been saying, the media climate in India, is there any prospect at all that your film will be released there? Has it been shown at all, even in private screenings?
Okay, so I think there is, it's a two-part answer. I have received a lot of love from people. Wherever I go out, whenever there's a post about the film, people are really, really waiting for the film to come out. And the film premiered in Toronto last year. We've been winning awards since. Every time I talk about, having won an award or, screened the film internationally, people are always like, when will you bring it back home? So there is a fair amount of demand amongst the audiences. I haven't so far had any offer from a distributor to put the film out, which of course is challenging. On my previous film, I made a very, very political film before this. And, I was able to release that in theaters and, it ran for many weeks. So I am hopeful that I'll be able to do that because ultimately I made this film for audiences back home. I made this film for my cousin, for my parents, for my friends. This film is made in a language in which I believe that I'll be able to communicate and speak to them. So I'd really like to show them the film, and I'm really, really hopeful.
Ahead of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's official state visit to the White House last month, the Committee to Protect Journalists and Other Organizations ran a full-page ad in the Washington Post highlighting what they call the press freedom crisis in India. The ad said in part, quote, India is the world's largest democracy, yet it's one of the world's most dangerous countries for the media, unquote. During Modi's visit, he and Biden held a joint news conference. Modi was questioned by Wall Street Journal reporter Sabrina Siddiqui, who's believed to be the first journalist to ask Modi a question at a news conference since 2015. This was the interaction.
Mr. Prime Minister, India has long prided itself as the world's largest democracy, but there are many human rights groups who say that your government has discriminated against religious minorities and sought to silence its critics. As you stand here in the East Room of the White House, where so many world leaders have made commitments to protecting democracy, what steps are you and your government willing to take to improve the rights of Muslims and other minorities in your country and to uphold free speech?
We have always proved that democracy can deliver. And when I say deliver, this is regardless of caste, creed, religion, or gender. There's absolutely no space for discrimination.
Following that news conference, the Wall Street Journal reporter, Sabrina Siddiqui, faced an intense online harassment campaign by supporters of Modi. Ravish Kumar, it's something you are very familiar with. First, were you surprised that she got to ask this question? And of course, underlying all of this is your views of what's happening to India under Modi right now, as he's being hailed by world leaders, what you see happening at home. If you could respond to all of that.
Yes, I was surprised, and I thought that whoever arranged this press conference done a great maneuvering job, because our prime minister, who comes from a leading democracy in the world, hasn't done any press conference in 9 years of his government. And he came to power on the pretext that earlier prime minister is not speaking, he's not a vocal man. Though prime minister gave a number of speeches, but he could not hold one press conference and take questions. And I was happy because for one reason, this is the one prominent questions which is chasing our prime minister to ask for many years. And finally, someone had got chance and she asked that question. This is the question he is running away. And in many ways, yes, this question, her question was representative of many questions which we are raising, that communal, vicious communal media has become so weaponized, and the communal hatred is so high in India. And there is a reason behind this. Anchors have a legitimacy, trolls have legitimacy, political support, administrative support. And the question was very right, and I do not think that question was answered very well.
And Ravish, could you explain the question of communalism in India? Muslims constitute about 14% of the country's population. 200 million Muslims or more live in India. Why are Muslims the target repeatedly of the Indian press?
Since 2014, nobody had idea. And if you look at the Muslims organizations, even they did not say anything which should be countered like this. They were very quiet. And but suddenly this media turned into a communal machine. It has become a factory of communal hatred. And anchors changed from within and they started spreading communal hatred. Even Supreme Court, Semi, in many occasions have strictly criticized this kind of media and asked question government that can't we stop this kind of media? But nothing has been done. If you surf any news channel, even right now, you will find one or other channel is doing communal agenda. So it has been legitimized by media. Media job was to question this kind of communal agenda, but it has become a direct tool to spread this kind of communal agenda. And the scale is very vast. I'm not talking about Indian newspapers. I'm only talking about here about Indian television. Shameful. There is no other issues are being covered. But every day, every anchor has come up with some kind of communal grievances and giving voices to majoritarianism. So this kind of television journalism we have, and we are not talking about this. Individuals have suffered because of that. There are many incidents where people on the street thought that they have a support of television. They have normalized such things. Then even at home, elders have discussing and legitimizing this kind of communal biases to in their younger generation. So no institution is there to stop. When lockdown happened during COVID, suddenly these channels started blaming one group of Muslims organizations, and many were arrested, targeted, and there were many places we had an incident like that. People went on the street and start checking identity card of fruit sellers, vegetable sellers, that show your identity card. If you are Muslims, you are not allowed to sell here. So it was a kind of atmospheres which was created by these television channels. And after many months, many courts have said that television channels have done great damage to this country, and this kind of fake news, fakery has been propagated by the news channel. So you have many official accounts of their communal agenda and criticized by the Supreme Court. I am not saying alone.
So, Ravish, explain, you've said that trolls have become the authority in India and authorities have become trolls in India since 2014, in other words, since Modi came to power. Explain the power of these trolls and how much false news, disinformation is circulated on WhatsApp and the effects of that.
Amy, when trolling started in Indian public life, many people who are active in public sphere used to tell me that these things will come and go. But I could sense that these are not social trolls. These kind of trolls are not coming from random part of the society, but it has a support. It has an institutional support. And now they have become an authority in itself. If they start trolling you, you will find that cases are being filed against you. You will find that police have reached to your doorstep. I know one female journalist who had to leave her town, who was a very bright young female journalist who was promoted a few days back, but because of trolls, she was fired and she lost her job, and she was brought to police station where these goons were asking her to apologize, and she had to apologize in front of the police. These trolls are not a normal trolls. They have the power of the day, power of the government. They may be invisible, but their impact is so visible on your career, on your life, on your mental health that you cannot imagine. And I am not, yes, I am the one case, but many female journalists are suffering from, their sufferings are not being told, and they are not, these tools have been successfully marginalized. Any journalist, any female journalist, their state of mental health are in great distress. So they have the power, they have the political power, and they have the legitimacy to drag you in any controversy, and they can do whatever they want to do with you.
Vinay, you end the film with Ravish winning the Ramon Magsaysay Award in the Philippines, considered the Asian Nobel Prize. The significance of this for you, Ravish, and what you're doing now as you resign from your position as this renowned primetime host on NDTV, as it was taken over by the richest man in India, allied with Modi.
I'm running my own YouTube channels, and yes, I've got huge supports from my viewers, and I have to say one thing, that we have been sentenced a kind of professional exile in our country. Many journalists like me are not getting jobs, and they have been isolated. So yes, if we had not YouTube, we would have not survived in this profession. So I am grateful to YouTube that I am earning my bread from that, but I do not know when this channel will be killed with one notice or one notification, and the uncertainty of this YouTube channel is great, is so vast. But yes, I am grateful that we all are, many people like me are earning their bread, but we have been sentenced to professional exile. Over to Vinay.
And Vinay, as we wrap up, I want to ask you how covering and living with almost Ravish Kumar's family, his community at NDTV for 2 years, changed you. You're a well-known filmmaker, but what this has meant for you.
I was honestly very, very surprised when I got there and I started shooting, because there's a public perception that you have. Ravish is a very fairly well-known anchor, and you know, people are polarized, people have very charged opinions about him. So when I began shooting, I was thinking that, you know, he'd have a team of 10 people and, you know, a lot of people around. He was operating from a very small room with a very, very small team. And I was also very, very impressed, as to put it very simply, by the amount of rigor and work that goes on within within the entire newsroom. I am very, very invested in processes. And when I was there at NDTV and on that floor, I was suddenly given a very clean insight into how much it takes from people to be able to do the job they do. You know, journalism has been dehumanized so much in the last decade or so. And for sure, there have been some bad agents. But the disinformation campaign against journalism has been so strong that we have forgotten to understand the processes of journalism. My film is, you know, my love letter to journalism. It shows you the cost, the emotional and financial costs that journalists have to pay to be able to do what they're doing.
I'm keenly
interested that we have a larger conversation around the systems of journalism. You know, very often we tend to focus, for example, today we have Ravish with us, and, you know, it's the story of NDTV. But for as long as we are concerned about one individual, one organization, one government, it's a very short-term, myopic view of things. It's fundamental for me to understand, at least in India and even across the world, what are the systems that we are building that will help us build a better journalism? You know,
Vinay, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to encourage people to see this profound movie. Vinay Shukla is the director of While We Watched, and Ravish Kumar is the acclaimed Indian journalist and author who's featured in the film. He was the senior executive editor of NDTV India, where he hosted primetime nightly news, the flagship weekday show. Tonight, I'll be moderating a panel with Ravish and Vinay after the film is shown at New York City's IFC Center. Next up, we speak to a first-grade teacher in Wisconsin who was fired for protesting a decision by her school district to ban her students from singing Rainbow Land, that hit song by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton. Rainbow Land by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show with a first grade teacher who was fired after she protested a school district's decision to ban students from singing the hit song Rainbow Land by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton during their school spring concert. Officials said they were concerned the song was not, quote, appropriate for the age and maturity level of the students. The song supports inclusion with lyrics like, wouldn't it be nice to live in paradise where we're free to be exactly who we are. The Waukesha, Wisconsin Board of Education voted to fire Melissa Temple after she complained in a tweet that went viral that school officials decided Rainbow Land was too controversial for students to perform. Superintendent Jim Siebert told Democracy Now! Tuesday in a statement, quote, the board found Ms. Temple did not follow board policy on multiple accounts, which resulted in considerable disruption to the district. The decision of the board was not about any particular song, but may or may not have been selected for a concert. But the process by which an employee goes about expressing their concerns in a productive manner in accordance with board policy, unquote. This comes as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports a group of parents, students, teachers, and members of the public are calling for the state's Justice Department to investigate claims of repeated discriminatory behavior toward LGBTQI plus students and staff by the Waukesha superintendent. For more, we're joined by Melissa Temple in Milwaukee. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. We just have about 5 minutes, Melissa, but I wanted to ask you if you can talk about what Rainbow Land meant to the students, why they wanted to sing it, and why they were stopped from singing it.
Good morning. It's really, really nice to be here. I'm just so honored that I have a chance to talk about this with you, Amy. So my students heard about the song. The music teacher introduced it to them. They had practiced it a few times with me, and in our daily morning meetings, the person of the day gets to lead the meeting, and then they get to pick a song. And so Rainbow Land was the song that they wanted to pick just one or two times before I was put on leave. When I was told that we couldn't sing it anymore, I wanted to just make a point that when I tweeted about it, my students were obviously devastated. They loved the song. They had gotten used to it. But I didn't view what I was doing as making a complaint. You know, the song had already been taken out of the program. The music teacher was conducting the program. It wasn't part of my specific job duties. But in addition to that, it was really horrifying to know that a school district's non-discrimination, our controversial content policy would go so far as to say that we couldn't sing Rainbow Land. So that's why I knew people were going to be interested to find out that that had happened. And I knew that it was going to create a lot of public discussion. And I think that's exactly what it did.
Well, what was the response, Melissa? Could you elaborate on that?
So in response to my tweet from the public?
Correct.
So overwhelmingly surprise, shock. People were saying, what's wrong with the lyrics? What's wrong with the song? I mean, I had a dollar for every time somebody said, well, I listened to the song and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it or why they didn't like it. You know, it's a really wholesome song. I equate it to any other song that we would sing. In fact, I would say Rainbow Land is ultimately even more of a first grade song than something like Rainbow Connection, because the message is just such a great piece and, like, you know, coming together song about acceptance.
Has Miley Cyrus or Dolly Parton responded to the kids not being allowed to sing Rainbow Land in their concert?
Both of those artists have library or book type foundations where they donate books. And Miley Cyrus did mention my students and make a donation to her foundation. But I haven't heard anything specifically from either one of them. No. I also wanted to mention as well that you asked me about the response. People have asked me, well, how many parents complain and what did they say? And I heard zero complaints from parents. Nobody has said to me that they wanted me to be gone. Nobody has said to me they didn't like the song. Nobody has said to me that they thought it was inappropriate for their kids. I had 24 students and zero complained to me or to anyone that I heard any administrators that I know of.
So, Melissa, just finally, I mean, have other teachers in your school district been similarly attacked?
Yes, I believe so, but their stories haven't gone public yet. But it is really dangerous. I think that these policies, like the controversial content policy, are expanding, and we're seeing that places like Wisconsin, where they haven't really been affecting our public education system, are now being affected. So teachers aren't allowed to wear rainbows in my district. We're not allowed to have signs that say anti-racist classroom. We're not allowed to have anything that could be deemed controversial, although the controversial content policy does not explain what controversial means other than it could something that could be seen as political. So we're seeing the same things that are happening in Florida and other places where we've all seen and been really horrified, and those things are happening in Wisconsin now as well. And I think it's really important that people realize that school boards and school board policies are really, really important, and we can't let groups like Moms for Liberty come in and take over and pretend that they're these grassroots, homegrown groups when they're really well-funded political organizations designed to take down our public schools.
Finally, you've been a teacher for 23 years. You won the Outstanding Teacher Award from the Wisconsin Badgers. You recently renewed your national board certification because of your commitment to the profession. We have 10 seconds, but there's a call for the Wisconsin Justice Department to investigate what's going on in the superintendent.
Yeah, I don't really know a lot about that because the parents in Waukesha and the Parent Alliance has been so amazing. I think that they're doing exactly what parents should be doing all over the country, and that is getting involved in their education of their children. And I really commend them for that.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Melissa Temple, first grade teacher at Higher Elementary School in Waukesha, Wisconsin, fired after publicly criticizing her school district over its decision to censor the song Rainbow Land from a school concert, the choice of song by the students. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Living in a rainbow land.
On Sunday, July 30th, join the SFU Pipe Band from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. for a free concert at the Academic Quadrangle near the pond at the SFU Burnaby campus. Experience a morning of exhilarating pipe and drum music with the world-renowned band before they head to Scotland to compete at this year's World Pipe Band Championships in August. The concert will be held outdoors, so please dress for the weather and consider bringing a blanket or chair to sit on. Hope to see you there.